It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. Doorbells with video cameras can catch a porch pirate in the act of swiping your package. They may also catch your neighbor in their bathrobe or maybe your neighbor's kids without their knowledge. Home video cameras are a useful tool for law enforcement investigating crime. Dozens of Wisconsin police departments now partner with Amazon, the maker of the Ring doorbell, to request private video footage. But that footage also raises privacy concerns. Today, we're revisiting the issue and a conversation from the morning show's archives. Here's WPR host Molly Stentz talking with Evan Greer, Deputy Director of Fight for the Future, a nonprofit advocacy group for digital rights.
So tell us about this program, this partnership that Ring, that Amazon has with police departments across the country.
Sure. I mean, you've got to hand it to Amazon because this really was a fairly brilliant marketing ploy, if something that's also harmful to our communities. But what Amazon has done is they're sort of bone grafting themselves to law enforcement institutions across the country and turning our local police funded through our tax dollars into sort of a marketing arm for their surveillance products. So Amazon has entered into now thousands of these partnerships with police departments across the country where police will offer subsidies or discounts on Amazon products and or simply encourage members of their community to purchase these devices. And in exchange, the cops basically get VIP access to request footage from these cameras with basically no checks and balances or oversight in place to dictate what they can do with that footage once they collect it if a homeowner decides to turn it over.
Okay, so break this down for me. Do police still need a warrant or a subpoena to get access to this data?
That is an excellent question, and unfortunately the answer is no. Really what this does is creates a technological end run around the Fourth Amendment. So rather than having to go get a warrant or a subpoena, police can now kind of press a button, send an email to dozens, hundreds, potentially even thousands of owners of these inexpensive, insecure cameras. And then any of those homeowners can basically press a button to send them the footage that they've collected. And again, there's currently really no laws or regulations in place that dictate how often police can do that, what purposes they can do it for, what types of crimes they can investigate by requesting footage from these devices. And they've openly admitted that once they do collect the footage, there's currently no rules in place dictating how long they can hold on to it, whether they can hand it over to other agencies like Immigration and Customs Enforcement, for example. And so we know that what's happening here is this is creating sort of a dragnet where police can request enormous amounts of footage and use it for all kinds of things far beyond what perhaps the homeowner expected it to be used for. Just to give one concrete example, we know through public records requests that police in Los Angeles used footage from Ring cameras to monitor Black Lives Matter protesters over the summer in Los Angeles. So there's a clear example of this being used not to catch a package thief or stop a burglar, but to monitor First Amendment protected activity by individuals protesting for racial justice.
So doesn't Ring, Ring says on their terms of service that they don't release user information to law enforcement except in response to a, quote, valid and binding legal request properly served.
Right. So that's if the police went to Amazon and said, hey, we want this homeowner's footage. What the Ring Neighbors app and the kind of law enforcement portal that they've created does is it allows law enforcement to, again, request footage from homeowners. The homeowner gets a notification or an email that says, hey, the police in your area have requested footage from this particular time period, right? And they're supposed to have a good reason. They're supposed to be investigating a crime. But what we've seen is that, you know, police could request footage for a very serious crime, you know, perhaps a shooting has occurred or something like that. And of course, people are going to be willing to hand over their footage. But again, the problem is because these partnerships are being formed completely outside our democratic process with no oversight from city councils or even mayors in most cases, There's nothing to stop the police from then using the footage they collect to bust some teenagers who were smoking weed in the park across the street, or for any number of other purposes far beyond that initial reason that a homeowner chose to hand over their footage to the cops. And again, the end result is that there's just more eyes and ears constantly watching our communities and our neighborhoods. And what we've seen in the numbers is that the proliferation of Ring devices is strongly correlated with a huge uptick in incidents of racial profiling. If you look at the Neighbors app, there is an enormous prevalence of people posting footage, photos, and videos of people who they say are suspicious in their neighborhood, many of whom are just people of color going about their daily lives, a delivery driver, someone walking their dog. And so what we know is that these devices, for the vast majority of people, they don't make us more safe. They actually introduce more risk into our communities by sort of turning neighbors against each other and exacerbating existing forms of discrimination and profiling that we already know are a problem in our society.
So how are they different, though, than neighbors? I feel like we've all had that neighbor that would the police come to their door, they would tell you what's going on in the neighborhood. They would, and maybe they would have opinions about the kids in the neighborhood that they would share, and maybe they were based in fact, maybe they were their own opinions, right? So how is this any different than neighbors kind of having suspicions about their other neighbors and sharing those with law enforcement?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think one way to think about it is imagine that that neighbor, and like you said, we've all had that neighbor, right? Imagine that that neighbor now has a surveillance camera trained at your front door from their front door and can watch every time you come and go. And, you know, they're not just looking out their window. They can do it when they're sleeping, right? And so, again, this creates this pervasive, constant monitoring of our communities, of our streets. And again, for me, the it comes down to, again and again, there's no policy to protect people, right? One thing, for example, we know is that more traditional companies that sell CCTV cameras to businesses, you know, tend to install those cameras in compliance with state CCTV laws, which vary from state to state. But many states have rules in place that say you can't install a camera on your home or business that's watching your neighbor across the street. It has to be monitoring your own property. Amazon puts into their terms of service that homeowners should comply with those laws, too. But they know that the vast majority of people are going to get this device in the mail, open the box, and stick it on their front door and never think twice about whether it might be violating some law that they've never heard of. And so they're sort of flagrantly flouting avoiding these statewide laws. It's early here on the East Coast. Sure. And earlier for you, they're sort of flagrantly avoiding these protections in place by sort of doing what they do across their entire industry, which is sort of outsourcing the problem, right? They outsource their drivers. They, kind of create externalities by underpaying their workforce. And now we see this example where they're creating what is essentially a privately owned surveillance empire or panopticon. And then they're throwing up their hands and saying, it's not our fault. It's the homeowners. They chose to put the camera there. The police request the footage. They said, yes, we're not responsible for anything that happens because of that.
That's Evan Greer, Deputy Director of Fight for the Future, talking with WPR host Molly Stentz. Fight for the Future is a not-for-profit advocacy group for digital rights. And we'll pick up this conversation about law enforcement, technology, and your privacy next here on the Ideas Network. Morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn. Ring doorbells have grown in popularity in just a few short years. They've also been hacked across the country. A Mississippi family sued the company after their 8-year-old was accosted by a stranger on the internet who was able to break into their camera in her bedroom. Like a scene from a horror movie, the unsuspecting girl heard creepy music and a strange voice suddenly coming from somewhere in her bedroom. Only this was real life. So do you have a doorbell with a video camera? Would you trust leaving a webcam in your house? We're revisiting a conversation this morning from the morning show's archives. And let's get back to WPR host Molly Stentz talking with Evan Greer, deputy director of the nonprofit digital advocacy group Fight for the Future.
What are our rights when it comes to this data?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the short answer is we don't have very many. Again, because of the lack of policies in place right now to protect people from this type of private surveillance, again, which is distinct from government surveillance, right? If the police had installed these cameras, that would make a difference in terms of our civil liberties. But again, Amazon has kind of found this ingenious but evil way to circumvent those democratic protections and that democratic process. Again, if police wanted to install a camera on all of our front doors, surely we would have to have some city council meetings. There would be some public forums. People maybe would even get a vote. In this case, your neighbor can stick one of these on their door. And if it captures footage of you or your children or your family members or monitors your activities, when you come, when you go, you know, where you go, there's really not very much that we can do about that unless we start demanding some policies. And we have seen in some cities across the country, city councilors starting to talk about ordinances that could protect people and or demand that police end these partnerships that give them, again, sort of VIP access to the footage that these cameras are collecting. And I think that that's really the direction that we need to go in. We've seen ordinances across the country banning invasive surveillance technologies like facial recognition, which have exhibited systemic racial bias and have been shown to exacerbate existing forms of racial discrimination within our criminal justice system. Amazon Ring is no different. It's a different type of technology, but it has the same effect. And so this is really one of those moments where we need lawmakers to step in and put protections in place to sort of update the law for these modern times where we're not just dealing with cameras on businesses or cameras on police cars, but we're heading toward a world where, you know, many, many people will have cameras on their homes, on their cars. We need protections in place so that our civil liberties don't slip away as the technology becomes cheaper and more expansive.
We're speaking with Evan Greer of the nonprofit digital advocacy group called Fight for the Future. And Evan, we've got callers who want to talk to you. Let's go to Michael in Elroy. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you for the conversation. I'm neither a liberal nor a conservative. I'm a middle-of-the-road guy, and I grew up in a small town in southwestern Wisconsin where within the last 5 years there's been two meth labs busted. And I think this is largely a solution in search of a problem, because way more good's going to be done by this than bad. Now, if indeed you feel that laws need to be passed, well, let's get them passed. But again, I think it's a little bit overblown at this point. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Michael talking about drugs in his neighborhood and the fact that this can be a tool. This can be useful for actually preventing crime. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and thanks for the call, Mike. You know, I think it's really important that we always look at the broader societal impact, right? You know, any type of policy or technology comes with real trade-offs. And, you know, certainly there are real issues in our communities that need to be addressed. What I would argue is we need to think about this a bit more holistically. You know, rather than just slapping a camera on the front door, can we start addressing some of the underlying problems that tend to contribute to what we call quality of life crimes, right? Especially things like package theft, where for the most part, people are stealing packages and selling them to buy food or to take care of their basic survival needs. If we had some protections in place, some basic policies to make sure that people weren't slipping through the cracks that way, that's actually been shown to do a lot more to reduce crime than increasing surveillance. We've also seen even basic measures like increasing lighting in downtown areas, just more street lights, have a more significant impact on reducing crime without any of the kind of added forms of discrimination that we're talking about with this type of surveillance. And then, you know, to go back to your original introduction here, Molly, you know, it's really important that folks understand that these devices are also not secure. So even if you're less concerned about the privacy, civil liberties implications, it's really important to understand that putting a internet-connected camera on your front door or in your child's bedroom makes your family less safe, not more safe. And there are steps that people can take to make these devices a bit more safe, but Amazon especially has shown a significant track record of, you know, moving fast and breaking things, as is the adage in Silicon Valley. And they rolled these devices out and have been selling them rapidly, even when they knew they weren't particularly secure. And the fact is, there's no such thing as an internet-connected camera that's 100% secure. So if you ask me whether I would put one in my room or my kid's room, I would tell you, heck no.
Well, Evan, we've got another call for you. Matt from Nisita is joining us this morning. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. So I think, to my knowledge, it's pretty well established in law, I think nationally, that you don't really have any expectation of privacy in public. Unfortunately, you know, I wish that weren't the case. But I think if we're going to point the finger or suggest laws be passed, it would be to prevent the government from surveilling, because they're doing it on such a ridiculously larger scale than, you know, Bob next door. To say that your neighbor can't have a camera, but, you know, Uncle Sam can everywhere all the time. I don't know. That's not where I guess I'd put my priorities. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. I want to go to another question we have coming in for you, Evan. We've got Adam joining us from Deerfield next.
Sure.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, good morning, Adam. What was your question?
Well, I'd just like some clarification. The guest had spoke a couple of times about the police having access to the footage from the victim.
You're breaking up a little bit. You're asking about what access the police actually have?
Yes, because they have to get consent from the homeowner that has the Ring device. Isn't that correct? I mean, they can't just access that information without authorization from the homeowner.
Evan?
Yeah, so I can jump in on kind of both of these points, because I think they're actually very connected. You know, to the first caller's point about, you know, sort of Big Brother, I think that's actually an excellent point. And that's really why we are so concerned. This is not about your neighbor monitoring you. This is about the fact that Amazon has created what's called a law enforcement portal that allows police to request footage simultaneously from as many Ring camera owners as they want within a certain area. They can literally drag and drop. Imagine you're on Google Maps and say, give me all the Ring camera owners in this area and send them a message asking them for footage. So the second caller is right. It's not that they have direct access. They can't just turn on your camera and watch whenever they want. But what Amazon has done is they've created sort of a seamless, expedited process for them to request footage en masse, which is a form of mass government surveillance. It's being enabled by a private corporation and private homeowners, but the end result is no different than what the National Security Agency did that Edward Snowden exposed, in terms of creating a dragnet effect where the police are able to vacuum up enormous amounts of data. They get consent from a handful of homeowners, but they're not getting consent from the people who are captured by those homeowners' devices, who are maybe just walking down the street, or again, the kids playing in the park across the street. And so when we think about consent, when we think about opt-in in this circumstance, yes, you know, it is sort of a legal foundation that we don't have an expectation of privacy when we're in public walking down the street, but that doesn't mean that we have an expectation that our every move is being monitored by these devices, and that footage could be handed over to law enforcement and used for any purpose with absolutely no checks and balances, and that police could request footage en masse for any purpose with no checks and balances there. That's not traditionally how policing has worked. And really what it does is it removes incentives for police to focus their attention on more serious crimes, when they can just click a button and request footage en masse for even the most low-level infraction. Again, like some teenagers playing in a park or someone stealing a package. I think we should have a higher bar for enabling this type of massive surveillance, given the harms that we've seen can come with it.
That was Evan Greer from the nonprofit advocacy group Fight for the Future, talking with WPR host Molly Stentz. To hear more conversations from the Morning Show's archives anytime, you can visit our program page at WPR.org/mornings. And if you have a program suggestion for our show, you can also find our contact info on the website. That's WPR.org/mornings anytime. Ahead this hour, we hear from a top executive from Madison-based American Family Insurance. It's part of our series of conversations this summer with executives from across the state. We invite you to bring your questions about the insurance industry to the table this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Don't miss Garden Talk today with Larry Mueller starting at 11 o'clock. They're looking at your midsummer garden. There's some harvesting to be done. There's some planting to be done. And there's some bugs that you might want to deal with as well. Larry's got it all for you this morning at 11 right here on the Ideas Network. Don't miss it. Garden Talk. I'm Lee Rayburn. News update is next, followed by a story from Our Wisconsin Life. All here on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and let's take some time for Wisconsin Life this morning. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about being pregnant during the pandemic.
Over the last several years, many profound experiences that typically would be shared with loved ones were lost in the pandemic. Rachel Poston of Milwaukee experienced this when her husband wasn't allowed to come to any of her appointments during her pregnancy. Poston shares her story as part of the Pandemic Pregnancy Project, which is documenting the stories of families and their babies and how they've been affected by COVID-19.
We had a Zoom meeting with our friend group, and one of them was pregnant, and she's not feeling a connection because she's not showing yet and doesn't feel any movement. My husband was saying that he understood because he didn't feel that connection with our pregnancy. It really made me think. During my entire pregnancy in Milwaukee County at my clinic, I couldn't have a guest at any of my appointments. Disappointment is an understatement. I lost that opportunity to have that bond with my husband, experiencing these new milestones in our pregnancy, especially to hear her heartbeat. When he was not allowed in, it was isolating for him a little bit, so his perspective on my friend's lack of connection to her pregnancy didn't surprise me. He saw the anatomy scan through a very blurry FaceTime. The realization that I'm here in a clinic with only the ultrasound tech, hearing that I'm having a girl for the first time and we both wanted a girl, and being alone with a stranger, there were moments when it didn't feel as real as it could or complete. He and I got jealous because we heard of other people's partners being able to go to their appointments because they were at a different hospital or a different county with different restrictions. We were told that maybe if we went to another county, maybe my partner could come with me. Or even in Milwaukee, just switch OBs to a different hospital or a different network. It's like, why do I want to give up this OB who's known me for years, who I trust, who I love? Things are looking up. I'm at 30 weeks, although COVID is still rampant, and my OB tells me that my husband can go to the growth scan after I've already scheduled it. I didn't know this when I scheduled the growth scan. Maybe the schedulers forgot to tell me. They assumed I knew the rules had changed. After my OB tells me this, I call the schedulers to make sure this change was correct, because I don't want to bring my partner all the way downtown to find out he can't go inside. So I call and tell me, no, the rules changed, he can't come in. He could have come to your first ultrasound. When was your first ultrasound? My first ultrasound was in October, to which she says, oh no, he wouldn't have been allowed to come then. The rules have changed so much. I know these changes were out of their hand. It's like, why are you telling a pregnant woman who's coming in at 30 weeks that her husband could have been there for the first ultrasound, then to take it back, then to say he still can't come, and expect me to feel emotionally okay about this back and forth, given the circumstances are also out of my hands as well. I sat in a waiting room, I called my husband, and I told him, you can't come. He says, oh, it's fine, it's fine, it's not a big deal, it's not a big deal. I haven't been there for all of them. And I say a lot of different things, and finally knowing this conversation won't bring him, I cry. I'm sitting in the waiting room, waiting to go in for an ultrasound, and I see a couple come out, a wife and husband, going on their way. I remind myself, it's probably their first ultrasound. The rules have changed. That's great that he can go, that someone else can experience what I wasn't allowed to. My husband did get to hear her when I had a false alarm and thought my water broke. So at least for the final big moments, we made it work. The world continues. When our daughter was born, he was there when he put her on my chest, and I just looked at her and said, "You're going to be one bad." And my OB was shocked. I'm a part of reclaiming that word. And my husband was there to witness this moment. And after I'd done this amazing thing of giving birth, we felt bad.
Rachel Poston of Milwaukee shared her story of being pregnant during the pandemic. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Now, the morning show's been talking to company executives from around the state to get their perspective on Wisconsin's business climate and our quality of life. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and you can listen to our other executive interviews anytime at WPR.org/mornings. Our next guest in our series is just stepping into their position as the Vice President of Inclusive Excellence for American Family Insurance. What role does inclusivity play in this Madison-based Fortune 500 company's bottom line? What are the costs of diversity, equity, and corporate responsibility? And what are the values? And why does it matter to you? Join the conversation, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email always available anytime to you, ideas@WPR.org. Cesar Pinzon is the Vice President of Inclusive Excellence at American Family Insurance. And Cesar, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, Ray, and good morning. It's great to be here today.
Yeah, just last week you were named the Vice President of Inclusive Excellence. Tell us a little bit about your new role and the responsibilities you now have.
Well, diversity, equity, and inclusion in our area of inclusive excellence really is kind of at the root of all we do. We've been working on this for more than a decade, but because we truly believe a diverse workforce positions us to outperform competitors, and it does result in more innovative approaches to problem solving. So the real key here is that our workforce represents the communities and the customers that we serve. That diverse and inclusive workplace leads to more productivity, better employee morale, higher engagement, and really important is retention. It's one thing to attract talent to an organization, but people have to feel like they are their authentic selves when they come to work, and that leads to higher retention traits. So we are deliberately focused on creating an inclusive culture and making that a high priority across the organization. And as a result, we're very confident that we've seen strong business growth from the efforts and from our diverse workforce.
A lot of companies have dedicated themselves to some aspects of diversity, equity, or inclusion. But last week, Cesar, we spoke with the UW System Alliance for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Advancement in STEM. What aspect does Advancement have when it comes to DEI issues at American Family Insurance?
Well, it's partnering with our communities at the end of the day. So we've made a lot of investments, specifically in Milwaukee. We've really doubled down. We've made over $10 million of investments specifically in Milwaukee that go from arts to education, healthy youth, and making community impact in our largest city. So, for example, investment of $1.2 million over the next three years in four Milwaukee sites called the Urban Future Center. So there's Sherman Phoenix, Journey House, the Milky Way Tech Hub, and Young Enterprising Society. And these really educate in programs in STEM disciplines and offer cultural events, mentorship, training, and entrepreneurial support. And we've been working on this since 2021.
And tell us a little bit about your background, Cesar. How did you come to be the brand new Vice President of Inclusive Excellence for American Family Insurance?
Well, I have to tell you, my journey has been a long one, and I've been so fortunate to be with American Family. I actually started as a scratch insurance agency owner in Illinois in 1999. And for those in the insurance business that knows what scratch means, you start with no customers, no policies. And on day one, you start writing business. So My first week was great. I wrote seven policies. The problem was they were my life insurance policies, my homeowner's policies, my auto, and my business policy. So, but from there, I've really had an opportunity to hold leadership positions across all of our sales division, all the way to regional sales. sales vice president. And then most recently, my last position was our agency and customer operations area, which supports our customers and agents through our call centers. And really proud of the work we've done there, establishing a team called El Centro, which is a Spanish language exclusive queue that we have in our care centers. And it's resulted in our highest customer satisfaction rates, great diversity across that organization. And again, our retention being one of the highest that we've had in the care center. So brand new opportunity for me, something I've been very passionate about because American Family from day one allowed me for the first time in my professional career to come to work, come to my agency and to the organization as my authentic self, being of Puerto Rican descent.
Cesar Pinzon, Vice President of Inclusive Excellence for American Family Insurance. But you also mentioned you got your start in Illinois. So I do have to ask, with that perspective, what about Wisconsin? What is it about Wisconsin that keeps American Family Insurance based here? This Fortune 500 company could be anywhere. Why Madison?
Well, Madison is really a great community. And even coming up every week as I was either an agent or in leadership, you could see the growth of Madison continuing. It's really becoming a tech hub. And really, we're strategically near Milwaukee, which is another area that we continue to invest in. We invest in Madison, Wisconsin, and really most recently, one of the bigger investments is in our Center for Black Excellence, which is a $2.5 million investment. And it's planned to open on the Madison South Side. It's going to be a 65,000 square foot destination. It's going to focus on wellness, leadership, innovation, performing and art visuals and programs for youth and families. So really, you look at Madison and say, this is a great place to live. It is a great place to work. It's a great place to invest in the community. And I've lived here now 9 years, and I can't imagine living anywhere else. This is where my wife and I plan to retire, and I'm going to get a little grief from my friends from Illinois, but I have no desire to go back to Illinois.
You can blame me for that, Cesar.
You got it.
Vice President of Inclusive Excellence, brand new position, just took it on last week, our guest from American Family Insurance. So how is American Family seeking to strengthen its diversity, equity, inclusion efforts going forward now, Cesar?
Well, some of the things that we continue to work on is really started, like I said, about 10 years ago. It's been a priority. We have started, that journey starts with typically with most companies begin, which is employee-led business resource groups. We started with a women's BRG, then a Latinx BRG, African-American BRG, and now we have 9 BRGs because the key to diversity is this is across all ethnicities, races, genders, sexual orientation, and experience and tenure. And so for us to be an inclusive workplace, a really important thing is making sure that our procedures, our policies, our programs, our processes eliminate bias. And that leads to having all this diversity of thought in the workplace. And again, as I said earlier, that's really what creates high-performing teams that collaborate better, innovate more quickly, and you retain that because you're really building a strong culture around a diverse workforce that also believes that in doing that, for that to work, you're representing your community, you're representing your agency force, your customers, and you make that investment because we truly believe that for companies to grow and to thrive, we have to see communities stronger than ever. And that's the responsibility, I believe, of business. And it's certainly at the fabric of American Family.
When you talk about representation, Cesar, do you mean matching the company's employees' demographics with census results, with your customer base? How do you see representation in a corporate goal?
Well, representation takes many forms. I think at the very beginning, the insurance industry as a whole is probably underrepresented or under-indexed in representation. So really, the goal is, why wouldn't, going back to when I was in Chicago as a sales manager, we would ensure that our agency owners are in the communities that they live, in the communities that they grew up, and they have that connection because they're the face of American Family and they're the ones at all the community events representing their business, representing the work that we do. And there's just a very natural connection and trust and authenticity that we build in our communities. So it makes sense that our workforce matches. And quite frankly, the pandemic has helped with that because it's allowed us to expand beyond what used to be our traditional 19 state footprint and is now allowing us to bring in teams with different experiences across all 50 states. So yes, you're absolutely right. It's really, how do we mirror our communities and do that authentically?
Cesar Pinzon is the Vice President of Inclusive Excellence at American Family Insurance, and we invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and let's get right back to our guest and your questions for him. Cesar Pinzon is the Vice President of Inclusive Excellence at American Family Insurance, where he started back in 1999 in Illinois and rose through the ranks to this new position, which he just took on last week. So what questions do you have for him and his role at American Family? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Stephen Sun Prairie, good morning. You're on the air with Cesar Pinzon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I know the guest talked about wanting to have diversity of thought, and that should be promoted. One of the things that many conservatives, libertarians, and even Christians feel is that they don't have a seat at the table, that they are excluded, specifically in relation to educational. Even NPR will sometimes not provide a platform for conservatives. And wondering what American Family is doing specifically to provide opportunities for people that are Christian, libertarian, or conservative to have a seat at the table. Thanks.
Steve, thank you. Cesar?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Steve. In our organization, we have, as I said, a great diversity, and that's across diversity of thought and across ideas. And we allow open, free space and comfortable space for people to talk, especially in the BRGs. We have a social channel internally for our employees that allows them to talk about Christian values and so on and so forth. We really want to make sure that people feel their true, authentic self when they come to work every day. And for American Family, we truly believe leveling the playing field for all to have equal opportunity to rise through the ranks of the organization or be their very best individual contributor, whatever their dreams are. American Family wants to ensure that we protect them and that we certainly foster those dreams. Because at the company, I can tell you, the one thing that we think is the most important thing are people's dreams. And inside those goals, we're here to support folks.
Hey, Cesar, BRG stands for?
Business Resource Groups.
Business Resource Groups. And they break out throughout American Family, and you've got employees in any number of them across the board?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's really, really interesting about our BRGs, these are all employee-led. So that's volunteer time. So this is work they do outside of their work to ensure that we're hearing the voices of all of our employees, informing decisions that we make, whether that's from marketing, you know, how our customers feel, very specific to the groups. And really, it crosses all the gamuts. We have veterans BRGs so that we truly understand the unique needs that our veterans are seeking from our workplace. Our LGBT, we have a women's BRG, as I said before. So nine of them in total. And really what it does is an opportunity for individuals to gain leadership skills in that. So we have a great structure around it where we have co-leads, and we call it our BELT, our BRG Executive Leadership Team. That allows individual contributors, managers wanting to grow their career to take on lead roles. And it's not exclusive to those that fall within that category, right? So the Hispanic Latinx BRG is led by a white leader from our claims area, and she is just a tremendous ally, and she is gaining great experience and exposure to executive leadership, the ability to present on key topics, and really organize and run an entire BRG for the entire year.
Cesar Pinzon is the new Vice President of Inclusive Excellence at American Family Insurance. And you've mentioned being your true self a couple of times now, once in reference to you and your position in American Family Insurance, and then in your leadership role, making sure it's available to other employees. And just tell me, Cesar, from your perspective, Puerto Rican American and within this new role, how important that is to you and why?
It's important because employees and customers are attracted to companies that stand for something. It's really important. And so you have to be able to see yourself there. That's where representation comes into play. And, you know, I, over the last few years, you get a lot of emails, and I'm kind of humble about it, but it's, you get emails from employees that when you send out a note that here's your bonus, congratulations, thanks for doing a great job this year, they send you an email back. It's wonderful to work here, and I want to thank you for being a Hispanic leader and making it clear that that opportunity is available to all of us. And so that representation really matters. But that authentic piece is critical, because if you don't feel like you belong, you leave. So diversity, and I've heard this many times, diversity is being asked to the dance. Inclusion and being yourself is being asked to dance.
Cesar Pinzon, we've talked on this show before about redlining in Wisconsin and some of the institutional racism that has been part of our history. Have you seen institutional racism in your work in the insurance industry? And if so, how do you go about combating that?
You know, I think it really is, again, investing in a community. And I would say I have not seen that in my time at American Family or in the industry, certainly here in Wisconsin. And if those things were occurring, I think companies have really made a very strong stand to do what's right. And as I said, just in Milwaukee alone, we've had $10 million of investments. A couple of the other ones I spoke to are our urban future centers, a few others, we've made $45,000 in neighborhood level investments for anti-reckless driving campaigns. We've made an investment of $1 million over 4 years in UW-Milwaukee's Luber Entrepreneurship Center. $10 million sponsorship for Summerfest, and that includes programs like Let the Music Play as part of a grant program that we support. 15-year partnership with Milwaukee Brewers that was announced in 2019, and that's allowed us to make continued joint donations of $200,000 for the Community Foundation. And one thing that I want to, you know, kind of make sure that is clear, those investments in the Brewers and the investments in Summerfest, those are naming rights in addition to community stuff. The other investments that we're making in Milwaukee are exclusive of those programs. So it's on top of what we see. But you have to support the communities, because if the communities don't thrive, our agency owners can't grow their businesses. American Family can't grow. And the more we grow as an organization because of that partnership with our community, the more we feel compelled to give back and better support our communities.
Do you think remote work policies have been helpful in improving diversity, equity, and inclusion, Cesar? And we're running out of time, but I am curious.
I actually think it's one of those things that created a forced innovation, right? Mm-hmm. It's easy to go day by day and say everything is running well, we're at our highest productivity. But when the pandemic hit in March of 2020, it exposed gaps. But in our space, I was really proud to say that within a week or so, we were able to get 90% of our workforce work from home. We've moved now to a hybrid environment. And really, it isn't about saying, hey, you have to come to work. It really more is about creating moments that matter and leaders coming in to have one-on-ones, to have events so that we collaborate across all of our divisions so that we're bringing people in for those moments so that that collaboration and innovation can happen. And then we find ourselves extraordinarily productive when folks are working from home for that head down time, that focus time. So it really, we're experiencing the best of both worlds. And from a recruiting and retention perspective, we are really holding tight. We've returned to pre-pandemic retention levels, and we are seeing huge pipelines of talent whenever we post a position.
Cesar Pinzon, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Lee. Have a great day.
Cesar is the new Vice President of Inclusive Excellence at American Family Insurance. I am Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.